This interview with Fran Dunwell was conducted on January 27, 2023 in New Paltz, New York, in a group setting. Other voices on this recording are Kara Lee, Nancy Beard, and Betsy Blair. The interviewer is Elizabeth Lojudis.
I'm Fran Dunwell, and I was born in 1951, the youngest of three children. I have two older brothers. I was born in Westchester County, but we moved to Poughkeepsie when I was two. My dad was an IBMer. And so I grew up in Poughkeepsie and spent my entire childhood there. My mom had studied biology, and she taught biology as a school teacher before she got married and before the war. My dad was a code breaker during the war, and then he transitioned from that to working for IBM, developing the IBM's early computers. So my childhood growing up in Poughkeepsie was very similar in some ways to what we've heard from our friends here, in that I also had a neighborhood that I had the run of. You know, there was it was a very safe neighborhood, lots of trees and parks and ponds, and my two best friends and I would get on our bicycles and ride our bikes through the neighborhood all day and go catch tadpoles in the pond. We had a climbing tree in our yard. It was a mulberry tree. And, you know, we'd climb the tree. We would just roam around outdoors all the time. So pretty much for me, my connection with the outdoors started early and just being, you know, roaming the neighborhood as a child. My dad probably only had a week of vacation, maybe two, but we spent every summer vacation when I was very young going to visit my grandmother, who had a cottage on the Chesapeake Bay, on the Potomac River, actually. And it was very, not very elaborate place. I think it had an outhouse, as I recall. And it had a small motorboat, and we would spend our day in the water and on the water, either swimming in the river or in a boat catching fish. Whatever we caught is what we ate for dinner that night. They had this little place called Crab Creek that we would go catch crabs. And I think there were oysters there as well. So that was a very vivid part of my childhood, was these vacations on the Potomac River, which is the tidal portion of the Potomac. And we probably didn't go there that often. I don't know how old I was when we stopped, but it's still very, very vivid in my memory and very much, I think, a part of what influenced me to want to work on conservation of the Hudson and Hudson fisheries and the Hudson River estuary. So when my grandmother got cancer, my grandfather died, my grandmother got cancer, and the trips to Virginia ended, and my brothers and I were all sent off to summer camp for the summer. So I went to summer camp in New Hampshire from about age 9 until I was 15 or so. And that was also a very formative experience for me because, again, everything was outdoors, so I learned how to swim. I progressed, you know, from beginner up to senior lifesaving, and we did mountain climbing in Mount Chocorua in New Hampshire. We learned canoeing, and I got to the point where I could, you know, operate a canoe solo and go canoeing on the Saco River. You know, it was really a really important outdoor experience for me, where I gained a lot of skills going there year after year. And so many different activities that you could do that were all outdoors: archery, tennis, horseback riding. So that was also a very formative experience for me. And when I was growing up, the Cold War was a common theme when I was very young. Like Betsy and Kara, I have vivid memories of being taught to hide under my desk in school because the Russians were going to bomb us, and this is how we were going to stay safe. But as time went on, I left the Spackenkill School, which is the public school, and went to the Poughkeepsie Day School from about fourth grade through ninth grade. And that was an alternative school that didn't have grades and was very oriented towards experiential learning. Our gym was a barn in the back of the school where, you know, there was a rope hanging from the beams. You could climb the rope, you know. It was pretty basic, but also a very welcoming environment and very oriented towards developing sort of a challenging way of thinking about things, not taking things for granted. The Vietnam War was going on in the 1960s when I was there, and that became a very big focus for discussion in the school about, you know, there was a couple of teachers who were very strongly anti-war, and they communicated that to us kids. And the civil rights movement was also going on at that time, and I was very much aware of that. And the environmental movement was sort of percolating, I'd say, in the background of that. So just growing up in those times, I felt like I absorbed a lot of that just because that's what everyone was thinking about, everyone was talking about. I eventually went to a Quaker high school, Oakwood Friends School. I was a day student. And I spent from 10th grade through 12th grade there, but actually my senior year, I was able to become a foreign exchange student to Germany. So I spent my senior year in Germany. So I was only at Oakwood for 2 years. But it was definitely, again, an environment where people would question things, and you were expected to think independently. It also had a whole emphasis on public service. And so I definitely absorbed some of that from Oakwood Friends School. And when I went to Germany, one of the things I think about now that influenced my choice of a career is that it was a really different ecosystem. The school was in northern Germany. It was on a very large lake. And every afternoon, all the students would go walking. You know, that's what you do in Germany. You go spazieren gehen, which is like taking a walk with your friends. And in Germany, they didn't have the same concept of private property that you have here. So you could walk on anyone's farm or field as long as you didn't destroy anything. So the whole countryside was our playground. And so we'd often go hiking to the lake. We'd go hiking through the farm fields. You'd go pick hazelnuts and berries. And it was just a very strong outdoor experience. And seeing how it was different than another country, how people related to nature in a different way, was eye-opening for me, I have to say. So while I was in Germany, I was applying to colleges. It was expected that you'd go to college, although an interesting thing for me is that in the era when I grew up, there were not many role models of women in the workforce. You know, the expectations were that after you went to college, you A, get married, and B, you could become a school teacher or a nurse or an accountant or a secretary. Those were kind of the professions that women would be in. And so I didn't grow up with incredible expectations of what I might do after I got my college degree. But my parents always believed in me, and I always felt like a smart kid. And so I definitely grew up with the feeling that I could do things, but didn't really have an idea what that might be. So when I was in Germany, I started applying to colleges, And my parents wanted me to go to an Ivy League college, but I was a bit of a rebellious type, and so I started applying to alternative schools. So I applied to Reed College out on the West Coast, and I applied to Kirkland College in upstate New York, which didn't have grades and was all focused on individual development and you know, being an inquisitive student as opposed to more of a regimented, you know, go study this and get your grades and graduate, you know, based on your grade point average. So that appealed to me, and when I was accepted to Kirkland College, I decided that's where I would go. And when I got there, I had never seen it before I went because I was in Germany. And so when I got there, I was very surprised to see the contrast between Kirkland College and the men's college next door, Hamilton College. Kirkland and Hamilton have since merged with each other, and now it's all one school. But at the time, they were two different schools and extremely different cultures. And it was really hard to get adjusted to being in this pretty liberal women's college where you were encouraged to follow your individuality, and Hamilton, which was pretty much pointing people to careers in either medicine or banking or law. And one of the things I had done in Germany was I had taken calculus. And I really did well in calculus because you didn't need to speak German. All the other classes, you know, was really difficult, but in calculus, you just had to know your numbers. And I'd always been good at math. So I took calculus in high school and thoroughly enjoyed it. And my math teacher in Germany, you know, took a shine to me and gave me a lot of encouragement. So by the time I got to college, it was one of the things I felt confident in. So I took calculus classes at Hamilton. I took 2 years of calculus and was surprised that I was actually way ahead of the other students. The word went out on campus that if you were female and if you took a biology class at Hamilton, you might actually be flunked in the class because you were female. Whether this is true or not, I don't know. But the Hamilton professors weren't so on board with women taking their classes, necessarily. And so I also took German classes there and started studying anthropology, which already in freshman year that appealed to me so much, the idea of connecting how people's cultures are organized with where they live and how they live. What are they eating? What are they hunting? How are they supporting themselves through, you know, their food systems? And how does that play out in their cultures? So I was really interested in that. And I think my father had encouraged an interest in that, you know, when I was growing up as well. So I took anthropology and decided very quickly that was going to be my major. I also decided very quickly that I didn't like being at Kirkland, and they encouraged people to take their junior year somewhere else, go abroad or go to another school or take a year off and do something else. So I applied to Pitzer College in California and spent my junior year at Pitzer College in California. And I think that experience in California might be what solidified my idea of becoming an environmentalist or an environmental professional. Didn't really know exactly what that meant, but I was really astonished by the fact that you could pick a leaf of a succulent or a cactus and stick it in some sand and it would grow. It was just so different. The ecosystem was so different from what I was used to back east. And I guess we must have eaten a lot of avocados because I I grew avocado trees in my dorm room. Just like that one. And made some really terrific friends out there. It was the first time I felt really like very free from the more, free from parents, I guess you'd have to say. And so my friends and I traveled all over California and really just had a wonderful time exploring California. And that's when I decided I wanted to do something in the environment, and applied for a job in Santa Fe, New Mexico. Didn't get that. And came back east, went to Kirkland to do my senior year, and it's like, oh, I just can't take this place. It was the same old thing again, except that a lot of my friends had graduated, because some of my friends were a year ahead of me. And so I decided that I was going to try to spend my final semester of Kirkland College back in Poughkeepsie, and which I did. So I had enough extra credits accumulated that I was able to just do a senior project in anthropology and get some odd jobs teaching arts and crafts. I was teaching weaving and fiber arts and teaching kids to play recorder and doing my senior project from Poughkeepsie. And my senior project, every paper I wrote when I was in the anthropology department at Kirkland revolved around the Iroquois Indians. And so my senior project was to do a study of the Oneida language and words for plants, which was something, you know, my father suggested that actually. He knew somebody who was teaching the Oneida language at SUNY New Paltz, and that man's name was Jack Campisi. He worked with some Oneida Indians from Wappingers Falls and Cold Spring. So I had a woman at the White Deer Trading Post that I would go interview and ask her about the Oneida names for different plants. And I took a class in the Oneida language from Mr. Campisi at the SUNY New Paltz. And I turned that into my senior thesis. So I was always interested in, again, this relationship of cultures to nature. So then I graduated. Didn't know exactly what to do. Was probably going to head back to California, where my best friends were at the time. But I started teaching at Poughkeepsie Day School, teaching weaving and recorder at Poughkeepsie Day School. And within a week or two, I met a man who eventually became my boyfriend for 11 years. And so then I decided to stick around, stay in the area. And wanted to still pursue some kind of environmental career. Clearwater at that time was having festivals on the shores of the Hudson in every river city. And so I went to a Clearwater festival on the shores of the Hudson. And they had some literature there where they were talking about the pollution of the river and how, you know, important it was to clean up the pollution. And I got really interested in that. So that would have been like 1974 or so. Clean Water Act was 1972, and most of the sewage treatment plants hadn't been built at that time. The river was an open sewer, and the PCB pollution was just getting to be an issue at that time. People were discovering that PCBs were, you know, harmful to human health and harmful to ecosystems. So these topics were described in the Clearwater Navigator, their newsletter. And I just, you know, really got interested in that and decided I needed to have some credentials in the environmental field if I was going to get a job. And so I started taking night classes. I really hated college. I did not want to go back to school, but I felt I needed to. So I took a class in environmental science at SUNY New Paltz. I took a class that was offered by four different colleges. It was held at Vassar College, but you could register through any area college. It was called the Natural History of the Hudson River Estuary. And so I registered through Dutchess Community College, which was the cheapest, but it actually was held at Vassar. And by that time, I was living in Arlington near Vassar. I could just walk over there. So I took that class, and it was offered once a week for 3 hours. And the first hour and a half was always an outside speaker who was talking about something they were doing professionally, and the second half of the class was some in-depth study on a topic. So one of the speakers was a man named John Harris Cronin, who was then running the People's Pipe Watch at Clearwater. And so I came home and told my boyfriend, oh, you know, they had such an interesting speaker talking about this guy who's tracking down pollution of the Hudson at Clearwater. And he said, oh, well, you know, his wife goes to art school with me. Let's have them over for dinner. So we got to be friends and, you know, socialized together a lot. And at some point, John told me, well, I think they're going to be hiring over at the Environmental Management Council. You know, why don't you go volunteer over there? And then maybe when they hire, you know, you'll be the bird in the hand and they'll hire you. So I did that. I went over to the Environmental Management Council. They had a project to protect the Wappingers Creek. I offered to volunteer. They had me do present a slideshow in the community, go to different community groups and talk about the Wappingers Creek and why it was important to protect it. So I developed a lot of public speaking skills. That was probably 1975. And then 6 months later, when they had a job, they hired me. So I became an intern working for the EMC.
Dutchess County.
Yeah. And the EMC had a council of community members that would meet once a month. So I got to know the members of the council. And then the fiscal crisis of 1975 hit, and I got laid off. I had only worked there, I think, 9 months at the most, and got laid off. But I had developed some contacts with people who were on the EMC by that point. And later that year, in 1975, a new Hudson River group was being formed called the Center for the Hudson River Valley. And it was a spin-off of Scenic Hudson. It was the same board members of Scenic Hudson. And they were trying to have a companion group. Scenic Hudson was fighting the Storm King case at the time. It was a single-issue group trying to defeat the proposed power plant at Storm King Mountain, which they eventually succeeded in 1980. But at that time, they were thinking, well, we really need to do something to take more of a comprehensive approach. We don't want to be just a single-issue organization. Let's create this separate organization called the Center for the Hudson River Valley and focus on coordinating all the little environmental groups that were springing up after Earth Day. So they were looking for a first director, and I got a call one day asking me if I wanted the job, completely out of the blue. And it turned out someone who was on the EMC board, Edna McMahon from Vassar College, had recommended me to someone who recommended me to someone else who recommended me to somebody else. And so I was hired literally on the spot by the Center for the Hudson River Valley, and worked there until 1980 when they merged with Scenic Hudson. So when Scenic Hudson won the Storm King case, the two organizations merged, and I became associate director at Scenic Hudson. And by that time, John Harris Cronin had, I think he got divorced by that time. Eventually, he got divorced and changed his name to the name he was born with, which was John Cronin. And he had joined the staff of the Center for the Hudson River Valley. He had contacts on the board and was offered a job working for the Center for the Hudson River Valley. And so he and I worked together, and he carved out a role for himself as a lobbyist working on getting state legislation passed in Albany. And after 2 years of doing that and being successful, getting a couple bills passed, he left the Center for the Hudson River Valley and went on to work in, I don't remember exactly the sequence. He worked for Congressman Hamilton Fish, a Republican, for a while. He worked for Maurice Hinchey, a Democrat in the state legislature, for a while. He was a commercial fisherman for a while, so I'm not exactly sure where that all fit in. But when he left the Center for the Hudson River, Cena Cutson by then had merged, and he was still there, but he left Cena Cutson to do one of these other jobs. And so Cena Cutson said, well, Fran, you have to take over his job as lobbyist because it's now January, and that's the lobbying season, and we don't have a lobbyist anymore. So I did that, and I was very nervous at first, like you've had this image of smoke-filled rooms and, you know, the old boys club. But I quickly found out that it really what mattered was to be able to articulate why you wanted certain legislation to be passed and what it was going to do and why members of the state legislature ought to, you know, be in favor of it. So if you could be, you know, clear in what you said, it really helped a lot. And it probably helped that I was an attractive young woman, you know, walking around the halls of the legislature. Certain people were definitely more than happy to have you come in their offices, and other people were not so supportive. Eventually, a lot of the Hudson Valley delegation came along, but they weren't necessarily in favor of the legislation we were pushing for at the time. Anyway, so I became the lobbyist for the statewide coastal management program, and I was made sort of chairperson of a coalition of statewide groups, or groups throughout New York State that were trying to pass this legislation. And eventually, we got the legislation passed. It was a very difficult time. You know, in the 1970s, there were all these laws that were being passed, the Clean Water Act, the Clean Air Act, the Toxic Substances Control Act, you know, you name it. By the time the 1980s rolled around, there was a big backlash against environmental legislation. In New York, the guy who was the chairman of the Senate Environmental Committee, Fred Eckert from Rochester, he had the idea that his job was to prevent environmental legislation from passing. And and there was a legislator from Orange County who was passing out bumper stickers, out of work and hungry, eat an environmentalist. You know, so that was the atmosphere in 1980. So we were up against it, but we did manage to get the State Coastal Management Program passed and a few other bills, conservation easement legislation, some the Greenway bill. I was only tangentially involved in the Greenway bill, but that was another thing that got passed in those years. So while I was at Cena Cutson doing this lobbying, I, by that time, was about 7 years out of college and decided I really wanted to get a graduate degree. And I had decided that, if possible, I should go to an Ivy League school. Again, because similar to Kara, having gone to Kirkland College, which was an obscure college that didn't even exist anymore, or was about to not exist anymore, going to a place with credentials appealed to me. And it turned out they were offering a fellowship for people who were involved in nonprofit groups to come to the university and be, you know, available to students and be visiting fellows. So I applied to the Visiting Fellows Program and was accepted to that, and was one of three people. So I got there in 1982, took a leave of absence from my job at Cena Cutson with the intention of going back after a year. But then after a year of doing that, I thought, well, really, I ought to try to get a degree. And I had audited a lot of classes and taken the exams, even though I wasn't a registered student. I took the exams, and so I asked the college if I could get credit for the classes I had audited, and most of the professors agreed to that. There was a class I took at the law school. They didn't agree to it, but I took classes at the law school, the School of Management, and the forestry school. And so then I signed up to go to school there another year and get a master's degree. But while I was home for the summer, I attended a political fundraising event for Assemblyman Hinchey and ran into Paul Keller from DEC, who was there. He was the regional director. And he said, well, we have this fisheries program that we started. It was something actually John Cronin had done when he was lobbying for scenic cuts, and he got the Hudson River Fisheries Management Act passed. And it called for a fisheries coordinator to be hired. And they had put somebody in the job, and it wasn't really working out. And he said, you know, I think you'd be perfect for the job. Do you want it? So I said, well, it sounds interesting, but I just signed up to go to graduate school, and you know, I'm starting in a couple of weeks. And he said, well, maybe you could work part-time, you know, while you finish your degree. So I said, well, you know, maybe. It's an option. It turned out the job didn't come through until May. And so one week after, one day after graduation, I left the forestry school and started working for DEC as the fishery coordinator. And I had also, it was a time when they were trying to hire women in state government. Mario Cuomo was the governor. And they were trying to use the political appointments that they had available to bring women in, because the civil service roles were, you know, you had to take a test to get in the civil service tests, and most of the people, not all, but most of the people who were on the civil service roles were men. And so they were using the political appointments to hire women. And so I was brought on actually as a political appointee. And I had been on the board of the Environmental Planning Lobby, which is now Environmental Advocates, and had met Lang Marsh, who was at the time the executive deputy commissioner at DEC. So in the end, I arranged it in this period when I was at school waiting for the job to come through, I arranged it that I would be able to report directly to Lang Marsh up in Albany and be part of the executive staff. And that's what happened. Lang Marsh had been actively recruiting women. He had actually reached out to me a year before if I wanted to be a deputy commissioner, but I didn't really want to move to Albany. So I had turned that down. And so anyway, I started at DEC in 1984 and stayed there till I retired in 2022. So I was there for a really long time. I remember 1980 was the year that we were stuffing envelopes,
mm-hmm.
because a friend and I had decided that we were going to try to have an influence on elections. And we created this informal group called ECHO 80, Environmental Candidates for Office, ECO, ECHO 80. And since we didn't have the ability to form a real political action committee, what we did was we reached out to people and asked them to send a donation in an envelope that had the return address ECHO 80.
That's what I was doing.
We approached Pete Seeger and asked if he would give us $100 to buy the stationery, which he did. And we picked two candidates, one Republican and one Democrat, Maury Cinci and Jim Lack from Long Island. He was the Republican. And evidently, I think we raised a couple $1,000s for each of them, which in the 1980s, that was a lot. And everything came in on this ECHO 80 envelope. So it made an impression on these guys. And we'll never know for sure, but I think it did probably help with our lobbying to to show support for people. They were both young members of the state legislature. I think they were maybe even both running for office, maybe for the first, you know, having been in office, maybe they were trying to get a second term or a third term. They weren't established politicians. So anyway, maybe that helped, maybe it didn't, but that's how I know it was 1980.
Yeah, interesting. And I had just come in 1980 to live down here.
Yeah,
I was brand new. Eventually joined the board of Environmental Advocates also, and I followed up on a fundraising project that I think Fran started, of were offering a boat ride on the Hudson, and people would pay $100 or whatever it was. And I did it a couple of years running, but I remember one year we had the boat was filled to capacity, and it turned out that the propeller had fallen off. It was the so we ended up having the party at the dock.
I think we were using the commander.
It was
right?
The commander, yeah.
Jean Wart,
yep,
and her husband,
yeah,
were the
people
captains.
Still had a very good time, and we raised the same amount of money we would have if we had gone out. So it all worked out.
Probably a lot more fun than if you had gone out and then lost the propeller.
Right. Right. Oh, yes.
Mm-hmm. So I think that's as good a spot as any to end my story. And
well, it's the what do they call it? What is it called? I don't know. The natal story, the nascent story, whatever it is, the beginning.
Uh-huh.
The origin story.
Origin story.
Origin story.
Origin stories.